Hi, I'm Tracy.
I'm April.
And this is Killer Spirits.
That our theme song never gets old to me.
It really doesn't.
I actually love it and I never want to change it.
And thanks to the guy in Bolivia that wrote it for us.
Yes, thank you.
I don't know who he was.
I don't know, but he did a good job and I really like it.
He did great.
It's haunting at the end.
It really is.
Yeah. So how was your week?
Good.
I'm excited for this drink today.
Me too. It's pretty delish.
Yeah. I want you to tell me all about it while I sip it.
Okay. So today's drink is called the Hangman. And our story today takes place in Buckinghamshire, and they call Buckinghamshire Bucks. It's like a short name for Buckinghamshire.
Probably because the place or the drink?
A long fucking name. The place.
Oh, the place. I live in the Bucks.
They call it like the Bucks. Yeah.
Oh, that's cute.
So I was like researching about Buckinghamshire now, and obviously we're talking about a historical event here, but that it's like a pretty posh place to be. So it's like the rolling hills of England place with like the pretty buildings, and so it's like sort of fancy.
Oh, okay.
So it's the Bucks.
I live in the Bucks.
So there is a cocktail called the Buck, and the Buck is sort of a genre of cocktails. It's made with ginger ale or ginger beer, citrus juice, and any number of base liquors.
Okay. So you can kind of mix it up how you like.
Yes. And a vodka buck is a Moscow mule.
Oh, I never knew that.
So buck, mule, whatever. The buck is believed to have gotten its name when someone added a shot of whiskey to the previously non-alcoholic horse's neck, which was ginger ale and lemon juice.
Interesting. They're like, hell with this. Yeah. Let's add some whiskey.
The added alcohol gave the horse a kick, hence a bucking horse.
Oh my God, that's very clever.
Yeah. So today I made a variation of a gin buck, which is also sometimes known as the British buck or London buck.
Well, it's very good. It's very refreshing. And I have to be honest, when people say ginger beer, I'm like, wah, wah, wah.
Yeah, who cares?
Like, I'm not really into ginger beer that much, but this is really good and it's not overly gingery.
Mm-mm.
You know, because sometimes it can be too much.
Like too spicy?
Yeah, like too spicy. But no, it's very refreshing. This is would be a great summer drink, I think.
Yes.
I would drink the hell out of it.
This drink, I made two of them. You could go more liquor heavy if that's what you're into. I went kind of liquor light because, you know, it's the middle of the day. So for two drinks, I did 2 ounces of gin, 1.5 ounces of the elderflower liqueur, the Saint Germain that we have. 1 ounce of lemon juice and split that between 2 glasses over ice. I have to shake it. And then I topped it with Reed's Extra Ginger Beer.
Well, it's like tart. I know I've already sucked it down. It's tart, but I like the fizziness of the ginger beer. And it's not overly sweet.
No, because there's no really added sugar. It's just from the ginger beer.
No, but the tartness really hits you on the back end.
Yeah.
It's really good.
And it's garnished with a lemon wedge. And a cherry.
Just oh, that's funsies. Lemon. I thought that was orange.
Well, it's a Meyer lemon.
Oh, got it. Okay, yeah.
So it's a little bit more sweet.
Well, it's beautiful. I love
it. Thank you.
So good. Well,
it tastes like those gin candies.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but not overly gingery.
No.
You know, because I'm not into a lot of ginger flavor. I'm like, no, thanks.
I like it. I could drink, like, ginger tea. Every day of my
life. Oh, really? Yeah. It's supposed to be good for your tummy, too. So drink this cocktail and it'll help your...
It'll be good for your tummy.
It'll be good for your digestion.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're right. Today we're going to go to Buckinghamshire.
And which seems like an extra long name for a place for no reason.
There's a lot of extra long names for no reason. Everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean...
Why do you gotta add the Shire?
I don't know.
It just can't
There's
be
probably a lot of history behind that I don't necessarily know.
About territories and...
I'm sure there is. Because that goes back many, many years. And someone listening probably is like, Yo, don't you know this? And no, I don't.
We do have listeners from England, so they're probably screaming at us.
Well, I've lived in England for a while, but I didn't go deep into the history of the names of things. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of names that are really long. But even here, we have a lot of names that are long for, you know, we don't know the history behind them.
That's true. And also call me out if Buckinghamshire is not the posh area of England, because that's what I read online.
Oh, okay. We know is what we read online.
It may be shit. I don't know.
I did not visit Buckinghamshire when I was there, so I actually have no idea. But so
told me.
Today we're going to talk about the Marshall Family Massacre, which is kind of an obscure case, I think.
So when I looked up this case, because I was trying to find like info for the drink, it was under. So first of all, it was hard to find.
It is.
And when I did find it, it was under the title Victorian Murders You've Never Heard Of.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
So I was like, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Because I haven't heard of everything, obviously, but this is definitely not on my list of stuff.
No, it's not well known, but it's a very interesting story. And what also drew me to it is the author of the book that I am basically
obsessed with.
I'm obsessed with and kind of obsessed with him. Hi.
Hi, who is it?
His name is Neil Watson, and the book is called The Denham Massacre.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so that's really where I got most of my research from. He did multiple years of research on this book, and he was a metropolitan policeman for 30 years during the mid-70s, ending his career in 2005, and he served at Cannon Row, Wembley, Harrow, and Pinner police stations, all in England, obviously.
Right.
So on the 7th of May, 2013, he was actually rummaging through a box of old photos with one of his friend's house in Pinner, Middlesex. And his friend, by the name of John Peters, was telling Watson about his grandfather, P.C. Thomas Pinner, who had served, actually, I think it's Thomas Piner, who had served at Pinner Police Station at the turn of the 20th century. And Watson had also served at Pinner Police Station at the end of his police career. So he was really interested in what his friend was talking about. But anyway, in this old box of items, there was a black-edged memorial card. And the card listed the names of Emmanuel Marshall and six other members of his family, covering three generations. So his friend John didn't know anything about it, but Watson was really intrigued and ended up contacting the Thames Valley Police Museum, which I didn't know existed, and now I want to go to. And he met with the curator, and that meeting led to the museum producing a glass display cabinet with items from the murders.
Mm.
Yeah, it was very cool. And he also met with the descendant of the superintendent that we'll talk about in this case. And he basically started a 3-year journey of research on this case. So There's a lot of research in this book. The book is fascinating. I highly recommend reading it. I also love how he really walks the reader through his research from like a very objective space. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like you're along the ride with him.
That's cool.
And it's really well done. He's also written some other books on police history, which is really cool. But anyway, I'm not talking about everything in the book, obviously. Yeah, so, no. Impossible. And I wouldn't want to, because that's his research. So I recommend reading it. He goes so deep into a lot of things.
I love it when that happens to people. Like, something catches their attention.
I loved it.
Okay, it's been 3 years, and I'm still like...
He's like, hello, rabbit hole.
I'm writing a book. Yeah.
That's
the ultimate rabbit hole.
I'll say. Yeah. And, I mean, he goes through a lot of the stuff that he did to get information, and he talks about some other sources that, you know, he doesn't necessarily agree with. Mm. But he's also really objective in the book, and he just kind of presents the information and draws from a lot of newspapers and, you know, because that's where everyone got their information. Back in those days.
It's a good mentality to have.
Yes.
When you're researching.
Yeah, I really like the tone of the book a lot. So let's travel back to England, 1870. Come with me, April. So this is 18 years before Jack the Ripper. To kind of put that in your mind, okay? So Emmanuel Marshall was 35 years old, and he had his own small family business in Denham, Buckinghamshire. And at the time, Denham was kind of a sleepy little village, and the census of the 1871 recorded population was about 1,234.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty small.
Okay, tiny. The parish of Denham covers 3,939 acres and was mentioned in the Doomsday Book of 1086 that we've talked about in our previous episode.
Oh, yeah, Doomsday.
Yeah,
book.
Doomsday. And the old English name for Denham, Denham, means homestead in a valley.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, pretty cool, huh?
Yeah. So Emmanuel married Charlotte Spark, which is such a great name. I mean, I love the name Charlotte, but the Charlotte Spark, I mean, come on, that's awesome. He married her in 1860, and together they had four young children, Mary, aged 8, Thirza, which is such a great name also.
Thirza. I've never even heard that name.
I know, isn't that great? Age 6, and Gertrude, age 4. Which, side note, my mom wanted to name me Gertrude and call me Gertie for short, I think is really cute. I would have hated it growing up, but I actually would have loved it right now. Because I like that name. And they also had a son, Francis, aged 19 months. Which also, side note, my mom wanted to name me Francis, too, and call me Franny. So that's really odd.
Franny is such a cute name.
It is really a cute name. I don't know. She went the gamut with her names, but she settled on Tracy, which, blah. Come on, Mom. You should have upped the ante a little bit. So in 1870, Charlotte would have been 31 years old. And Emmanuel's parents, William and Mary, had lived in the house for many years until his father's death in 1857. So his mother, Mary, had become a widow at 64, but she stayed in the house, so she lived with them.
Oh, okay.
In 1870, she would have been 77 years old. So Emmanuel earned his living as one of the village blacksmiths with his own forge attached to the house. So basically he worked right there, which is really cool, I think. Nice. Yeah. So the Marshalls had lived in the house for over 40 years. So this is his family home. And Emmanuel's father, William, had lived on the property before him and had planted an orchard there. And the Marshall home was described as a two-story cottage set in an acre of land with two magnificent rows of ancient elm trees forming a long shaded avenue. It was located on Cheapside Lane. And a newspaper of the time recorded the Marshall pantry, which I just love. This is why I love newspapers back then. They just went in so much detail. Their pantry is, quote, "In the pantry was evidence of comfortable preparations for Sunday dinner, a leg of mutton, some pounds of beefsteak, butter, bread, eggs, rhubarb, and a small cask of ale."
Oh, so they were comfortable.
Yeah. So, yeah, so much detail. I just love that. Yeah. So there was also several pubs in the village, which I'm going to name them because I fucking love these names. Okay. The Green Man, The Swan, The Plow, The Falcon, The Dog and Duck, The Gravel Digger's Arms. No, I think it's actually The Grave Digger's Arms. Sorry. Oh. I don't know now. Because I remember thinking The Grave Digger's Arms. That's such a great name.
Yeah.
The Hare and Hounds and The Lambert Arms.
I like the, I would probably drink at the duck one.
Yes, the Dog and Duck.
The Dog and Duck.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Yeah. The Hare and Hounds is cute too.
I feel like the Dog and Duck would be like a hunting bar. Yeah. Like they would have taxidermy animals on the wall.
They would have to. And there would just be like guns hanging up. The village also had two schools and a Methodist church. So as the local blacksmith, Emmanuel would have been considered working class, but he was also a cut above the average unskilled laborer at the time. Like a farm laborer or a factory worker. He was above that. So he would have been viewed as a skilled local artisan.
Oh, okay.
So 1870 was still very much the age of the horse. So he would have had plenty of work at that time. He would have made horseshoes and wheels for carts and wagons. And he would also make things like agricultural and kitchen tools. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he definitely was doing well. Watson's book also lists some interesting information about the wage of different kinds of workers at the time, which I'm going to read because it kind of gives you an idea. Mm-hmm. So records from 1867 recorded that there were 130,000 blacksmiths in England and Wales.
That's kind of a lot.
Yeah. The records also showed that blacksmiths were paid more than ordinary manual workers. So soldiers earned about 12 shillings a week. Farm laborers earned 14 shillings a week. Miners and postmen, 21 to 23 shillings. Blacksmiths, seamen, and lace makers earned 25 shillings. And then, of course, further up the scale, you have bakers, butchers, and cabinet makers.
Hey.
And they made about 28 to 30 shillings a week. So watchmakers, jewelry makers, and engine drivers made 35 shillings a week. So he was kind of in the middle. Yeah. I would say he's middle class. He made a comfortable living. Emmanuel was also described by the paper, the Bucks Advertiser. See?
The Bucks.
Yeah. He was a hardworking man that was somewhat excitable, and his temper was not the best. Hmm. But he was a kind husband and father.
I mean, he was a blacksmith. It does take a certain attitude to do a certain kind of job.
Possibly.
Yeah. In my opinion.
Yeah. Charlotte was described as an excellent housewife and that her children were the best behaved in the parish.
Oh.
So as the end of May 1870 was approaching, Emmanuel's sister Mary Ann was actually preparing for her wedding. The ceremony was due to take place on Tuesday, May 24th in the Denham Parish Church. And she was engaged to a gardener by the name of George Armour from Sodbridgeworth. Sodbridgeworth.
What a good name. George Armour.
George Armour. There's so many good names in here. Shall I pause after each great name and tell yes. you? Because there are so many where I'm like, oh my gosh, that's a great name. Like, why are we not George named George Armour? So Marianne was staying with her brother's family, Emmanuel, prior to her wedding date. So that's just setting up the Marshall family.
Who is there?
Who's there? Who's residing?
His sister, his wife, his mom, mm-hmm. him, and his three kids.
Yes. So let's talk a little bit about John Owen. John Owen was born June 8th, 1832 in Byfield, North Hampshire. Okay. It's Northamptonshire.
Hamptonshire.
Yes, which is also a great name. So John was the sixth of eight children, and John's father was a tailor. And of course, in those days, the sons usually followed in their father's footsteps. Right. They did what their dad's profession would have been. So his older brother did follow in his father's footsteps, but John did not want to be a tailor. So he ended up became an apprentice mm-hmm. with a master blacksmith by the name of Thomas Mason. And he actually lived with them for a time in 1851, and he would have made a nice living for himself if he continued on this path, but he'd go off the rails at one point. Okay. Yes. So in 1853, he settled in the small town of Shipston-on-Stour, about 20 miles from Byfield. And he married a widow by the name of Hannah Russell on the 6th of February. She was 44, and although the marriage certificate said that he was 30, he was only 20.
Oh.
Yeah, so there was quite an age difference. She owned a confectionery shop, and her little shop...
He must have lied, though, about being...
He did. I'm sure that they wanted the age difference to look less.
Yeah.
I mean, in those days, it's not like, can I see your driver's license?
You like, just write your shit down.
Just write your shit down. Everything was trust, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was a thing. So, so she owned a confectionery shop, and her little shop was actually famous for sausage meat and pork pies.
That's awesome.
Which sounds delicious, and I want one right now. So, in April of 1853, very soon after he married her, the rails had been... He went off of them. Yeah, very quickly. He was prosecuted for selling tobacco on a Sunday, which I guess was a thing. And it was, I guess, a new law. And he was like, I didn't know about this law. No one told me, blah, blah, blah. So they were kind of like, okay, whatever. We're going to fine you 5 shillings. He was also working for a local blacksmith at this time named Robert Lovett. And John, decided it would be a great idea to steal a pistol from him. And about 7 months later, that pistol was found in his possession. On January 2nd, 1854, he was found guilty and sentenced to 6 weeks in the Worcester jail.
Oh.
Yeah. He never said what he was using that pistol for specifically, but it was the rumor around town that he was using it to shoot cats.
What?
Yeah. And the newspaper, and we don't know if this is true. This was probably speculation.
Yeah.
But newspapers actually suggested that he was possibly using the cat's flesh in the pies that his wife was selling in her confectionery shop.
Okay.
Your face. Your eyes went really big. So
this is like, anytime I hear about somebody having a pie shop, I just think of Sweeney Todd. That's all I can think of.
Yeah.
You are murdering people and turning them into pies. Spoiler alert. That's Sweeney Todd. But that's always what I think of.
Yeah. And I know.
Like pie shop in England.
Right.
You're selling people's flesh.
Selling people. Sorry. Or cats.
Yeah.
Which is funny because remember, cats. I know we talked about this in the other episode with Warwick Castle when they uncovered a bunch of bones from the one shop that was there and realized that they were using cats for their
disgusting pies.
So go cats. Back and listen to the episode. It's a really good one. The history and hauntings of Warwick Castle.
Oh, yeah. That was like episode 5?
I think so, yeah. But I have a distinct memory of talking about that.
The cats.
So,
poor cats.
Yeah. So the locals started calling him Jack the Cat Killer.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So of course, while he was away in prison, his wife lost her shop. I mean, do you really want to eat there after the newspaper is suggesting such a thing?
Oh, shit.
No, of course. Yeah. You do not. Her business.
She fucked up your reputation.
No, he fucked her up.
You could probably sue for defamation nowadays.
Probably, that's true. So, you know, she was a woman about town. She landed on her feet and she opened the Roebuck Beer House.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Pretty cool. But he screwed that up for her too, because when he was released from jail, the police objected to the liquor license due to the fact that he had a firearms related offense. Oh. So she lost both of her businesses.
Fuck.
And John's response, he leaves her, goes on the road.
What?
Bye.
She probably didn't want him there anyway.
Yeah. And who knows what the history was of that. She might have been like, you know what? I'm out. I'm done with this. Yeah. You've already messed up two of my businesses. We're out. So, and that was probably better for her anyway. He left. So John would end up using a few aliases. He would use John Jenkins, John Reynolds, and most notably John Jones. In November 1859, he assaulted a police officer, and he was using theft as a way to supplement his income. I don't know if supplement is probably the right word. I don't know if he had any income. He might have been working as a blacksmith around this time, here and there, here and there.
He probably did have some skills.
He did have some skills. So on April 24th, 1866, calling himself John Reynolds, he was convicted of stealing leather driving reins valued at 2 shillings and 6 pence. So he stole them right off a horse, I believe. February 1868, he was in trouble again for stealing. And on the 8th of July, 1868, he was sentenced for stealing a ewe and a lamb from a farmer, in which he took the head, liver, and heart to a shop to sell. Oh. He got 18 months for that one. That was a lot longer than he'd gotten for anything else before.
Yeah.
And there's a smattering of other offenses sprinkled all throughout there. So yeah. He was, you know, the police knew him very well. The papers described him as a miserable looking creature, and he was most likely living on the streets at this point because it was difficult to find employment. Mm-hmm. I mean, even with skills, it's difficult to find employment at this point. Right. So possibly prison was a better option for him. I mean, at least he had food and a dry place to sleep. And he would also be sentenced for stealing socks at one point, which is also interesting because I guess he said that he had a skin condition on his feet, and possibly if you don't have the proper shoes, the proper socks, you have malnutrition, I'm sure his feet were a sight.
Yeah.
And so he actually stole socks, which is kind of sad.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of tells you a little bit about the, you know,
condition he was in.
And kind of the social structure at the time. It's not like there was a lot of help for that.
Yeah.
So John Owen, aka John Jones, would cross paths with Emmanuel Marshall at some point. The newspaper called the Sydney Empire, said, quote, "It has been ascertained that 3 years ago he worked for Marshall, and while repairing the wheels of a neighboring farmer's cart, so burnt them that the owner refused to have them and sent them back. On account of this, Marshall stopped the prisoner's money, and Owen became exasperated, struck Marshall in the eye, and a fearful fight between the two ensued."
Oh.
So the theory is that basically John did a shitty job. Emmanuel was like, "I'm not paying you." Mm-hmm. They had an altercation, and John has been pissed about it.
Okay.
For a long
3 years.
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the weekend, the 21st through the 22nd of May, at the Marshall home would have been full of house decorating for the wedding and preparation for the final band's ceremony. I don't know if you've ever heard of a band ceremony. I had not.
No.
So the banns of marriage, commonly known simply as the banns, B-A-N-N-S, or bans, B-A-N-S. It's from a Middle English word meaning proclamation, which is rooted in Old French. It's the public announcement in a Christian parish church of an impending marriage between two specified persons. Hmm. So the purpose of the banns is to enable anyone to raise any civil legal impediment to the marriage, as to prevent marriages that are invalid.
Oh, like, hey, I'm already married to her.
Yeah.
She can't.
There could be a multitude of.
Yeah.
I feel like in a way we kind of do that now, except we don't have like these. I think they did it 3 times in the church prior to the marriage. Now we just say, "Does anyone object?" And if no one doesn't speak, what do they say? If you don't
forever hold your peace
or something like
but,
that.
You know, you could just get married at the courthouse and nobody.
Yeah, and nowadays it's a little different. Object. I just feel like that's our little snippet on the bands, you know?
That's interesting. I thought you were saying bands, like wedding bands. Bands.
Oh, yeah. No, bands. B-A-N-N-S. Gotcha. Yeah, so it's very interesting. So, remember, Marianne, Emmanuel's sister, was staying with them prior to her wedding day. And it's not really clear if she was staying there, for how long she was staying there, but she was there, and it could have just been, like, you know,
preparation and, you know, yeah, being close. Yeah, whatever. So because of this, the little Marshall baby, Francis, who was 19 months old, would actually be staying with relatives for the time being, which makes total sense to me. Because if I was planning for a wedding, I'd be like, can someone take the baby, please? Someone take the baby. So someone took the baby.
Yeah, especially he's almost two. He's running around.
Oh, my God. He's wild at this point. Yeah. So that was good because this would be the weekend of a horrific massacre in the home. Baby. And the removal of baby Francis would definitely save his life.
Yeah.
So I will start out the story that way. On Saturday evening, the neighbor Elizabeth Simpson reported later that she did see Emmanuel and one of his daughters on Saturday night. So they know everyone was intact Saturday night. Mm-hmm. The next day, of course, was the Sabbath, and the Marshalls would have attended church, especially since Marianne's final bands were being read that day.
Oh.
So Emmanuel was known to be an early riser and would sometimes get up at like three or four to work. Sounds a lot like my husband. I don't know if he's working, but he's up that early.
That's
every day.
That's the dad.
It's like the dad thing. Yeah. So it is believed that Sunday morning he would have risen early to get some work in prior to going to church. Hmm. 3 a.m. Sunday morning, local police officer PC Charles Trevenor was out on his patrol around Denham, and he stated later that he came across, we will now later know as John Jones. At the time, he didn't know that who this was. But he ran across a man on Sunday morning at 3 a.m. And he thought he might have been out poaching. And he was also looking mighty suspicious being out that time of night. Like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. And so this would be some pretty damning testimony later, as John was definitely in the vicinity.
Oh, gotcha.
Okay. On Sunday, May 22nd, the Marshalls did not show up for church. No one thought much about it at the time. Maybe they were just going about their daily lives. But on Monday, May 23rd, Charlotte had plans to take tea with her sister. Her sister's name was also Marianne, Marianne Spark. But when she came around to the house, no one answered. And she was concerned because that's not normal. I mean, also, when you have a bunch of kids running around and your shop's, like, why would it be so quiet?
Your sister-in-law is about to get married.
Yeah, the house is, like, shut up. Everything's really quiet. It's, like, it's odd. So she actually saw, she went to some neighbors. They didn't know anything. And she actually saw two men walking nearby. And she asked one of them to, could you get a ladder and look inside for me, please? Yeah. And his response when he climbed the ladder was, for God's sakes, come here. So because of what he saw through the window, they broke down the door. And when they saw what they saw, they rushed to the police station and reported it. So PC Trevenor, who was the one out patrolling at 3 a.m., was summoned to the scene at 7 p.m. Monday evening and walked into a bloodbath. Oh. Emmanuel Marshall was discovered face down in the forge with serious head injuries. His wife, sister, mother, and three daughters were also discovered with serious head injuries, but they were in the house on the ground floor. So Emmanuel was lying on his face with his arms stretched out, and it looked as if he'd been dragged. And I'm going to go a little bit deeper into the injuries pretty soon, so buckle up. Okay. It's children. Oh. So I'm just letting you know. Babies. It's not an easy read. So Emmanuel, his body was covered with a sack, an apron, and an old coat. A pool of blood and a poker were a few yards from his body. There was a large hole in his forehead, most likely inflicted by a poker, which was found broken in two near his body.
God.
His head had been beaten, and his arms had several cuts and bruises as though he had struggled with his assailant. I'm sure. His boots were missing from his feet. Now, Charlotte's body was discovered inside the kitchen, along with Emmanuel's sister, Marianne. Marianne was still in her nightclothes, but Charlotte was partially dressed over her nightclothes, which kind of makes it seem as if she might have heard something and maybe tried to dress herself while she was running down the stairs to see what was happening. Yeah. Mary, Emmanuel's mother, and the three children were found in the back kitchen. So there's like two kitchens. Yeah. And they all had significant head injuries. So she probably took the children in there to hide, but yeah, they were discovered. So. They were found with one of the little girls still in her arms.
Aww.
Yeah. So the Belfast newsletter remarked, quote, little clean things belonging to the children were all untouched, and their little shoes left clean for Sunday remained as they had been placed on Saturday night. It just gives you a picture. I know. Yeah. It's so sad. So later at the inquest, and this is where I'm going to really kind of get into the injuries, 28-year-old Dr. John Spencer Ferris provided his opinion and a very detailed account of the injuries. He said each victim received a lethal blow to the skull so violent that the skulls were able to be pulled apart.
Fuck.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Charlotte Marshall was lying with her head against the wall. Her skull was covered in blood, and the wall close by was also smeared with blood. Marianne Marshall was lying with her feet on Charlotte, with her head the other direction. Her head and face were covered with blood. In the back kitchen were the bodies of the grandmother, Mary Marshall, with her arm around the body of the youngest child, Gertrude. The heads of both were covered with blood. In the fireplace were the bodies of Mary and Thirza, one on top of the other, with the heads again covered in blood. It almost seems like they were just thrown in there like a heap of trash.
Yeah.
To me. So by the side of the forge, the doctor saw the body of Emmanuel Marshall completely covered with a sack. He was lying on his face with his legs toward the back of the forge. After removing the sack, he saw two large wounds on the back of the head, and when he turned him over, he found his face completely smashed in. He was unrecognizable. On the back of Marshall's left hand, there was a severe bruise, and the right finger was grazed. And there was no wound or bruises on the body or other limbs, but it did look like he had probably tried to fight, but mm-hmm. not much of a struggle. So the front of Emmanuel's face and clothes were covered in ashes as if the body had been dragged along the forge. His upper and lower jaws, even the bone under the eye, were completely smashed in.
Holy cow.
On his head, the hair was matted with blood and there were ashes in it. The scalp wounds were probably produced by a poker and the smashing of face and fracture by a sledgehammer on the back or the back of an axe. So he used multiple weapons.
Yeah.
Thirza, age 6, had the whole right side of her skull smashed, most likely from one blow of a sledgehammer. Mary, age 8, had a semicircular wound about 5 inches in length on her head, which almost completely cut off her right ear, a small wound above the right eye, and other wounds on the back of her head, and near them a starred cut, he said. So 3 of those wounds were made by a poker, but the starred cut, they couldn't figure out what instrument that was made from. They couldn't figure that one out. And there was also a wound on the right side of her face, and both jaws were broken. Inside the skull, there was a puncture wound corresponding with the starred cut on the outside, and the base of her skull was fractured across, dividing the skull in half. Gertrude, age 4, all the bones on the left side of her face were completely smashed in, and the temple bone alone was intact. And all the injuries were probably done to her body by a sledgehammer. Mary, age 77, she had a fracture across the base of the skull. So I just wanted to tell you all that so that you just get a picture of the violence.
The rage.
The rage and violence of those injuries inflicted on the family. So after the murders, the killer climbed the stairs, proceeded to rifle through all the bedrooms, and even smashed a glass photograph of Emmanuel, which shows you he was pissed. Mm-hmm. That seems personal to me.
Yeah.
So the killer changed out of his bloody clothing and put on one of Emmanuel's suits, leaving his bloody clothing behind. He just left it there. And then he took Emmanuel's boots right off his feet and wore them out the door. He also stole a watch, a knife, a pistol, and a carpet bag. And the items of clothing stolen included a coat, a waistcoat, trousers, shirt, braces, collar, boots, straw hat, and a necktie. Yeah. So, and the fact that there wasn't much of a struggle in the forge, it kind of points to the fact that whoever did kill them probably snuck up on him.
Yeah.
And I would say, in the book, Watson agrees that he was most likely killed first, because you always want to take out the person that's going to stop you
right. The
most. Yeah. So that's probably the order was husband, wife, sister, grandmother, children.
Yeah.
That's the thought. So at this point, 37-year-old Superintendent Thomas Dunham was called in to investigate. And Superintendent Dunham had about 17 years of experience in police service. So, yeah, he wasn't a rookie.
Mm-hmm.
He had some experience. Scotland Yard also became involved, and Inspector William Palmer and Detective Sergeant Robert Walker were dispatched to Uxbridge. Detective Sergeant Robert Walker actually wrote a report to his superiors dated the 24th of May, 1870, regarding the facts of the case. And part of it read, quote, I beg to report that most. Let me start. I beg to report that a most diabolical murder has been committed in Denham Bucks, a small village 2 miles from Uxbridge. There is no doubt they were cut down with a large axe and their heads afterwards beaten with a large hammer. Both these implements were found covered in blood. Yeah. The earliest theory was that Emmanuel killed his own family, then himself, like a family annihilator.
Yeah, but how is he supposed to inflict wounds like that on
exactly
himself?
That was very quickly dismissed. Yeah, no. Based on the crime scene and the injuries and all of that. That didn't make any sense. But, you know, you got to start out somewhere.
Explore all avenues, right.
And, again, there was no apparent struggle, so they feel that he was probably, the killer snuck up on him. So on Tuesday, May 24th, was Marianne's wedding day, the day after the bodies were discovered. Her fiancé actually showed up at the Uxbridge station Tuesday morning, and they had been separated for a month, and he knew nothing of the murders.
Oh, no.
And I'm so sure that he was excited. This was his wedding day. I can't even imagine.
And hadn't seen his bride in a month.
And he was finally told what happened, and he was devastated.
That's so sad.
Absolutely devastated. Yeah. In fact, he would never marry. And he passed away in 1917 at age 76.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think that shows how devastated he was. Mm-hmm. He never married. So news of the murder spread quickly, and soon a frenzy of sightseers and reporters, between 3,000 and 4,000, arrived in Denham, asking to see the corpses.
Stop.
Don't you just love Victorian times? So also, funny. Just the fact that travel was not easy. It's not like you could just get in your car and be like, hey, let's go to, you know, the next town over or whatever. Like, this is a program to do these things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So only those with permission from the coroner could enter the home, thankfully. But there were many reporters that they just let traipse through there. That's why they're telling you about what's in the pantry.
Oh, okay? Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, Victorian times, the good old days.
They're like, what are we going to write about? Oh. Everybody's already got a take on what happened to these bodies. I'll write about the pantry.
I'm going to write about the pantry, which actually I kind of liked reading. Yeah. So an inquest into the deaths of the Marshall family was held immediately after the bodies were discovered at the Swan Inn before Mr. Frederick Charlesley. The jurors... It's very interesting. The jurors were also required to traipse through the home and view the bodies. So they did not move the bodies. They wanted the jurors at this inquest to go in and see them.
Wow.
Yes. So the Freeman's Journal reported, quote, when the sheet was lifted off the grandmother, still clasping the youngest child closely to her side, and the three little girls, their bodies thrown promiscuously one over the other in the corner, and all still in their night dresses. The jury was quite overpowered. Many of them sobbed aloud. All were in tears. The ghastly wounds inflicted on the heads and faces of the children could not disguise the fact that they were beautiful.
Oh.
I know, isn't that awful? So the inquest adjourned until Friday, the 27th of May. And again, if you read the book, he will go through every minutia of these. There's multiple inquests. He will go through all of them. It's very interesting reading. Who said what? Who the jurors were by name? It's very cool.
Wow.
But anyway, it was adjourned until Friday, 27th of May, to enable the police to prosecute their investigation. Like, get it moving. Let's go. At the next hearing, the jury would hear evidence from the doctors who had conducted the postmortem examinations. So on that Tuesday, Superintendent Dunham was visited by a bricklayer named Charles Coombs, who lodged in the Bell Yard in Uxbridge. And he had been lodging there for about 12 months. And he knew a man who also lodged there, and he knew him as John Jenkins. Now, Jenkins could only afford to sleep in the common lodging house. He was poorly dressed. He never had any money. Mm-hmm. Coombs sees Jenkins. He sees Jenkins on Saturday, and he looks like his regular disheveled self. And then on 10 a.m. Sunday, Jenkins sashays into the kitchen of the lodging house looking like a proper gentleman. He was in possession of a carpet bag. And Coombs stated, quote, he was wearing a black coat, black tie, nice white shirt, boots with false buttonholes, and he had a dark cloth coat, which he had before the 2 months, and a fustian jacket to cover it. A fustian jacket. And a very narrow brimmed hat. Basically what he was saying is he was dressed to the nines.
Yeah.
I didn't even hardly recognize the dude. Mm-hmm. So Jenkins' story was that his brothers had given him this clothing and money. Okay. Mm-hmm. But then Jenkins started throwing money around. He's buying people drinks. He's basically acting a fool.
Yeah.
Drawing attention to himself.
Right.
La-di-da. After news of the murder spread, Coombs was like, you know, this Jenkins guy is really, really suspicious. Mm-hmm. That Monday morning, Jenkins had also asked Coombs to accompany him to a pawn shop where he pawned a gold watch and chain. And on Monday, 8 p.m., as they sat in the pub drinking, a young boy came in, and of course, you know, news of the murders had spread, and a young boy came in and was like, oh my God, there's been murder. There's 7 people murdered. And Jenkins was reported to put his head down, trembling violently, and then immediately asked the landlord for a timetable of the Great Western Railway. He was going to skip town.
Yeah.
You know? So Coombs was like, again, you're a really suspicious dude. So that's why he went to the superintendent. When he was at the superintendent pulled out the bloody clothes that were left behind at the scene, and Coombs was like, oh yeah, those belong to John Jenkins. I recognize them.
Oh, jeez.
So Jenkins had also told Coombs that he was headed to this Reading, which was another town over. Mm-hmm. So he told the superintendent that, and the superintendent was like, okay, dude, you're coming with us. Like, they took Coombs with them.
Okay.
And
you can identify him.
Went to Reading. Yeah. So at this point, kind of like a needle in a haystack. It's not like you're using credit cards. Can't track you.
Yeah.
But he did get lucky because Denham visited the Reading superintendent by the name of James Purchase and 25-year-old Detective William Hounsell Tolman. William Hounsell Tolman. Come on. That's a great name. He happened to be there. And Tolman heard the description of Jenkins and then told him that he had seen someone matching that description pass over High Bridge in the direction of Silver Street. So knowing that Jenkins was most likely going to stay at a cheap lodging house, they targeted the Oxford Arms in Silver Street, which was very well known, I guess, to the police at the time. Hmm. So early Tuesday evening, they arrived there because the Oxford Arms was like a hotbed of crime.
Right.
The cops were like, okay, well, if we're
gonna, where else would he go?
Where else is he going to go? We pretty much figure he's going to go to this place.
Right.
So they show up, and the description they had of Jenkins was pretty vague. So it was imperative that they had Coombs with them. Mm-hmm. They also had to be cautious because they knew he had a pistol. A pistol was stolen from the Marshall house. Yeah.
He didn't pawn it.
Yeah. As far as they know, he didn't pawn it. So they knew that he had it. So Coombs did identify him, and he was seized very quickly. And they found him wearing clothing belonging to Emmanuel Marshall.
Ugh, gross.
And the boots. Yeah.
What a creep.
So they took him in. As they were taking him into custody, though, he cried before they even told him what you're being secured for. He said, quote, I have not murdered man, woman, nor child. It's like, dude, we didn't even tell you what we were arresting you for yet. So, yeah,
that's weird.
That's kind of telling. They discovered Emmanuel's pistol in his pocket, as well as the pawn ticket for Emmanuel's pawned watch.
Oh.
Yeah. And Jenkins was, of course, John Owen, a.k.a. John Jones.
Yeah.
And so reporters from this point on pretty much referred to him as John Jones when you read the newspapers. So, of course, word of this arrest spread, and people were out for blood.
I bet.
Yeah. When the police returned by train with John, the crowd was there yelling and pushing. The police had to push their way through the crowd, and at one point, John was struck in the nose by the crowd and started bleeding.
Damn.
One local newspaper described his appearance, quote, prisoner John Jones is rather under medium stature. His countenance is repulsive, but not remarkably so. His eyes are keen, though sunken, and suggest much cunning. He has an unpleasant appearance, aided by the fact that his hair is short, suggesting the manipulation of the prison barber. He has a haggard expression. Admission to the court was denied to the general public. Hmm. That was his description. And
is there a picture of him?
There is a picture of him in the book.
Hmm.
interestingly, there's a picture of him alive and there's a picture of him dead.
Okay.
If you want to see. You know how they used to do the dead shots?
Postmortem.
Postmortem pics. Yeah. Postmortem pics. Yeah. No, so there is a picture of him in there. Hmm. I mean.
Is he ugly?
No. Oh. I mean, what I was going to say is that, you know, the newspapers are always very skewed.
Yeah.
Like, they're very like, oh, he's a bad guy, so we're going to make him seem bad.
Seem disgusting.
We're going to make him seem disgusting. So a different reporter also mentioned his appearance in court. In court. Quote, the suspect is 5'7", has a Scotch accent, sallow complexion, dark beard cut short, dark eyes, brown hair and mustache, painter's cap, white smock and striped trousers. He wasn't Scottish, though, but Watson suggests that because he was from Birmingham, he had what they would call a Brummy accent, and so it might have confused the reporters because he wasn't Scottish. So John Jones' initial court appearance would be to determine if he would be tried for murder, obviously. So it was determined that he would, and he was remanded to Aylesbury Jail. And again, read the book. You can it's pages and pages long, this whole thing. So the jury was not an easy one because when they arrived at the station with John Jones, again, a crowd attempted to grab him and basically lynch him on the spot.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So John received injuries. The police received injuries. It was pure madness. There's actually a drawing in the book that was in a newspaper at the time. And it really does make me laugh because it's like this throng of men like surrounding someone. And then there's like an old lady with an umbrella hitting him. Which is just so like,
I love
did
it.
That really happen? Are you just, it's so, you know, cliche. But anyway, that was the picture of the book.
She's,
I thought it was so
she's
funny.
Screaming, she's like, shame on you.
So John Jones' story throughout his case was that he did not commit the murders, but he knew who did.
Okay.
But he would never reveal who it was. He would never say.
He had no snitch.
I don't think he knew snitch either. He also ascertained that he received this clothing and items from someone on the street after the murders. Right. Yeah, they didn't kill you as a witness.
Right.
But they gave you all this stuff.
Yeah.
There was a lot of circumstantial evidence against him, as well as witnesses who saw him near the murder location. And the fact that he would never, quote unquote, reveal the real murderers made no sense to anyone.
Right.
In the course of their investigation, the police did find evidence that John had sustained a terrible head injury at 15 years old, which could actually explain a lot. When he was, when he was working as an apprentice, he was struck on the right side of his head with a pickaxe and it nearly killed him. I mean, I only mention this, and not much is known about head wounds and behavior changes in Victorian times, you know, like trauma, but it's an interesting aside.
Well, you know? I mean, it's, yeah. I mean, that's the case now. It happens
exactly
a lot.
And when you kind of look at, especially serial killers, it feels like, oh, there's a head injury. Mm-hmm. Ta-da! Yeah. You know? I mean, that's not always the case, but it is interesting. So John Jones was put on trial at Aylesbury Assizes on Wednesday, July 20th, 1870. And again, I'm sorry if you listened to my first episode and I mispronounced that.
Assizes.
It's Assizes. Neil Watson goes into a lot of history around the court system during that time, too, which is really fascinating. One tidbit that I thought I wanted to mention that I thought was really interesting is that there was no discussion with the prisoner of a lawyer until the trial actually started.
Oh.
And then the counsel would be procured at that point, and then they would have about 48 hours to determine, like, what defense they have, to read everything, to prepare a defense. Like, it's kind of crazy. Hmm. So nowadays, luckily, that doesn't happen.
Yeah, because you're like, I mean, you could be giving up a bunch of information. I mean, there's a reason why you have the right to remain silent.
Yeah, yeah. So that's kind of interesting how, you know, the history of how, you know, our court system has changed over the years.
To
be
questioned with an attorney, because I'm sure people get completely bamboozled. Railroaded.
Yeah, bamboozled.
Yeah.
And railroaded. So John Owen, a.k.a. John Jones, was found guilty. And when asked if he had a response, he said, nothing.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah. No, that was the word he used. He said nothing.
Nothing.
The jury had deliberated for 2 minutes.
Is this the same jury that went to the house and saw the bodies?
No, that was an inquest jury.
So this would have
been a different jury. Yeah.
Gotcha.
much. They like to do inquests there, which I don't really feel like we do here. Maybe we used to in the old
what
days.
What even is that?
An inquest is usually like presenting the information, like the, you know, it's basically a way to look at all the evidence. And then they it's almost like how we have a grand jury.
Oh, like how it's interpreted through the plain
yes. and
person's
so, like,
eye?
Well, and you know how you'll go to a grand jury and then they'll say, okay, yes, let's try him for murder. Or no, we're not going to try him for murder.
Oh,
does that
I
make
see what
sense?
You're saying. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like a pre-jury.
Yeah, but they also do an inquest just for informational reasons, too.
Huh.
They do that a lot. So, yeah, so they deliberated for 2 minutes, which I thought was crazy, but I guess back then that wasn't so crazy. Hmm. Nowadays, juries can deliberate for days and days and days. And I was on a jury once, and I wanted to tell everyone out there who's ever been on a jury, I'm so sorry for you, because you get in the freaking delivery room. You get in the deliberation room, and then you realize you weren't all at the same freaking trial.
You're like, did
trial.
You guys hear what I heard, or what?
I just walked in there thinking, oh, we're just going to all be on the same page. No, they were on a whole other books. I don't know what happened. It was a horrific experience.
That's a bizarre one.
That's why there's a movie called 12 Angry Men, because I wanted to kill people.
I bet.
I didn't, though. So during sentencing, Judge Baron Channel, again, Judge Baron Channel, that's a great name. Mm-hmm. He announced, quote, I trust you will make the best use of the time which is left to you in this world, and that you will endeavor to obtain forgiveness and pardon for the offense which you have committed. I have only now to pronounce the sentence of the court upon you, which is that you be taken from here to the place from whence you came, that you then be hanged by the neck within the walls of the prison, and that you be buried within its precincts, and may the Lord have mercy upon your soul. John's response, thank you, my Lord, with a wave of his hand.
He didn't feel shit.
I don't think he did.
Yeah.
So he was sentenced to be hanged in Aylesbury Jail on Monday, the 8th of August, 1870, at 8 o'clock in the morning. And you can just see how fast all this moved.
Yeah.
Like, this was May to August.
Yeah, they're not wasting time.
There's no wasting. So after, remember, and I know I've mentioned this before, after 1868, hangings were no longer a public spectacle.
That's right.
Because people got whack-a-doodle-doo. Oh, yeah. They loved it. They brought their kids out. They had lunch. Oh, they had parades. Sick. It was a thing.
Sick.
So now there would be only...
Parade?
I don't know. It seemed like it. There would only be a handful of people who were allowed to witness this one.
Oh, okay.
So 2 days prior to his death, he actually requested to have his coffin brought to him, and he proceeded to sleep in it for the next 2 nights. A little weird. Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean...
What?
I don't... Yeah.
Like with the top closed?
I don't know.
What a weirdo. That's bizarre.
It's a little bizarre. I thought that too.
He had some pretty severe issues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the morning of August 8th, he woke up at 3:20 a.m. and he had a breakfast of a pint and a half of tea, a 2-pound loaf, and 2 plates of meat. At 8:03, the bell began to toll and he was met in the corridor by the hangman, William Calcraft, who was actually really famous around this time. There's a lot in the book about him. And
as a hangman?
Yeah, and a lot of hangings he did and a history around it. It's very, very cool. I mean, I feel like we could have a whole podcast just on William Calcraft.
Ooh, let's do it.
Which I kind of want to do. So the procession was formed, and he was accompanied by Mr. Sheriff Tyndall, Mr. R.C. Seeley, who is a surgeon, Superintendent Jervis, the warders, and the chaplain, reading a part of the burial service. Which seems so, like, are you walking while reading? That just seems so ominous to me. Mm-hmm. So the hangman then placed him on the drop, placed the rope around his neck and the white cap over his face. John asked to make a statement, which was permitted, and he said, quote, my friends, I am going to die for the murder of Charles. What's his name? I forget. Oh, Charles Marshall, but I am innocent. Well, his name wasn't Charles.
His name wasn't Charles, you fucker.
Unless that was his middle name, and I just did, but I didn't see any mention of his name Charles, so I'm not sure if he got it wrong or, yeah.
Maybe he's just being an idiot.
Maybe that was his middle name, but I didn't see that at anywhere.
That's weird.
I think he just got it wrong.
Yeah.
After his statement, he fell 2.5 feet, and it was reported that the death was almost instantaneous. Mm-hmm. After an hour, the body was cut down.
Yeah.
So Francis Marshall, the little baby.
Yeah.
Who escaped this massacre.
Just by total coincidence.
He was raised by family members, but sadly he died at 18 of tuberculosis.
Oh.
I know. Which is really sad. And I also an interesting aside to this, because mm-hmm. you know I always like to bring in the hauntings.
Oh yeah.
So haunted? This house was torn down at one point and there was other buildings built. Okay. Other houses built. But over 100 years after the murders, in 1986, there was an article that appeared in the Police Review magazine. And it does make for interesting reading. So the article was written by Inspector John Pearson, who had worked in the Denham area for many years. So make of this what you will. Mm-hmm. At 2 a.m., the police station door flew open and a man and a woman rushed in with their faces white as snow. This is part of his article. The two frightened people were very anxious to relate their story to someone. The wife told them that their house stood on or around the site of the old smithy where seven people had been murdered. And she said that the spirits had been very disturbed. And she and her husband could not stay in this house any longer. On several occasions, the wife heard a body as if in severe torment rushing from one corner of the room to the other in the bedroom above her. When she went up the stairs to investigate, a cold, damp wind always blew strongly in her face. And black fungus grew overnight.
What?
Yes. There was also things moved around the house and ornaments shifted as if moved by some unseen hand. And this house, which was dubbed the murder house for a while, remained standing until very recently in the 2000s. And it was demolished to make way for flats.
Dang.
So, yeah, there is some hauntings around that area or some unrest of the spirits. So,
how are you going to go into a police station, though, and say that?
Like, what must have been very scared. What the fuck are they gonna do? He just wrote an article about that. Was it? I don't think he did anything else.
I'll take note.
Thanks. He's like, let me take note of this. That's the story of the Marshall Family Massacre in Denham.
Oh.
Interesting, huh?
Quite the story.
It is quite the story and very sad. And, you know, they didn't see stuff like that back then.
Not with a town of 1,300 people.
Yeah. I know, crazy.
Yeah.
And I'm just so sad about Frances. I wish she hadn't died of consumption.
Oh, yeah.
AKA tuberculosis. But yeah, very, very interesting story. And like I said, go read the book. I know I've said it a million times, whatever. But Neil Watson, I feel like, I didn't even look up a picture of Neil Watson, but just reading the book, I feel like he's swoon-worthy.
Yeah.
Just a feeling, I
guess. Maybe you should include a picture of him.
I probably should. I'll have to look him up. But anyway, it's a great book. Highly recommend it. The story in and of itself is great. And I kind of want to read his other histories of police.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting.
So, and hey, we'll look more into Hangman. He had a very interesting life and story.
Yeah, I recently... So, have you heard of Soft White Underbelly?
No.
What's that? So, it's sort of like a documentary style... it's a photographer, but he made a documentary. He has for years taken pictures and done photography of like the untouchable parts of our society, sort of. So like drug addicts,
yeah,
escorts, prostitutes, homeless people. So he, in this documentary, Soft White Underbelly, he's actually sat them down and is interviewing them.
Oh, that's amazing.
But one of the people he interviews was a warden of a prison in like Kansas or something, or Alabama, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the person who does the actual execution.
Oh, so he's the executioner.
Right.
Okay.
So, like, he's technically the person who pushes the button.
He's the hangman of today.
Yeah. And he had an interesting, because, of course, that's what he asked him about.
Like, oh, yeah.
I want to know about, you know, how many people he executed. I think he said 17. It was less than 20.
Okay.
And he asked him, like, do you have any feelings about it? You know, do you feel any, like, remorse for killing those people? And he's like, basically, I didn't really kill them.
Interesting.
Like, I pushed the button,
but I'm not the one who did it.
I didn't decide that they were supposed to die. I'm just following orders. Like, I don't...
Yeah.
I was there. I pushed the button.
technically I it's did his job. Do it.
It's literally his job.
Yeah, but I'm not the one who put this person here.
And I feel like you'd have to separate yourself in that way in order to even do the job.
It was just an interesting interview. Wow,
that's very interesting. Yeah. Now, Colcraft, the hangman, his body count was in the hundreds.
Wow.
And there was very interesting stories about some of them. So
let's do it.
Oh my God, that's such a great one. Yeah.
Write it down.
We're going to do it. So, wow, thank you guys for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Hope I didn't bring you down too much on this Sunday.
It was a good story. Actually, it was. For some reason, it's easier to separate myself from a story that's very old.
Yeah.
Than a more modern story.
I see what you're saying.
Like, the 1800s stories don't really bother me that much. When you talk about, like, the 70s or, like, the 80s or, like, more modern times, I get kind of, like...
Yeah, but it's still... Ugh. See, I feel the same regardless.
Yeah,
it just... It's so terrible to me. Because I think in your mind, you're thinking, oh, they'd be dead by now anyway. That sounds terrible, but you know what I'm saying?
Well, I guess, like, that far back just feels like people of a different time.
Well, they were a different
But I mean, it's like they're not of
somehow,
us.
Like, connected to you in any way.
Yeah, they're not of us. They're, like... It's basically like telling me people from another planet.
Oh, yeah. But it's not.
I know.
It's really not.
I know.
It's weird. I know. I actually had some really great podcasts to plug, and I'll do it next time. But
okay.
I've been listening to some really good ones, and I always like to share them because I do a lot of research on finding really good podcasts to listen to. And so especially the really good ones with investigative journalists who really delve deeply into, like, missing persons cases. Yes. I really, really love those.
Yeah.
I actually do remember one now off the top of my head. It's called The Accused, or just Accused. And it's three seasons, and she's an investigative journalist. And Amber Hunt, I believe her name is. It's so good.
I love the ones that have you, like, on the edge of your seat.
No, it was on, and, you know, there may not be an easy tied-up bow at the end of them, but just, I mean, she's like a bulldog. It's really interesting to listen to her interview people, too. So anyway, go listen to Accused. It's really, really good. And thank you guys so much.
Thanks for listening. I'll tell you where you can find us.
Yeah, I was going to say.
If you want to shoot us an email, reach out, say hi. Tell us about a story you want to hear or a cocktail you might want to see.
This cocktail is delicious.
Thanks. You can email us at killerspiritspod@gmail.com. We're also on TikTok at killerspiritspod. We're on Instagram at killerspiritspod and Patreon, patreon.com/killerspiritspod.
Yes, and please write and review. We love to read your reviews, and you know, email us,
reach out and say hi, and check Instagram for pictures of all of our cocktails and pictures to go along with the stories.
Yes, we love you guys.
Bye.